come to order. We are especially appreciative of having the joint meeting, and I extend our welcome to Representative Mariani and to our colleagues in the House. We'll do introductions very shortly. I especially want to thank Senator Rummel, who has been chairing a special subcommittee, a work group that is focused on the topic we have here today. She's also working with Senator Lynch on this, and we have other members, but Senator Rummel has put together a lot of the background work, and I want to acknowledge it. This is a very important issue on the agenda today for testing, measuring what is being accomplished, and obviously it's being discussed by school boards to Congress, and hopefully will contribute to providing better public policy direction in Minnesota. I'd like to now yield to Representative Mariani, and then we'll do introductions and go to the agenda.
Thank you, Senator. It's good to make the cold walk across the street over to the Capitol from the state office building. It's cold even in the tunnel on days like this, but thank you for your hospitality here today. And for agreeing to work with the House on a number of important issues during the interim. I think it's a good practice for both bodies to be able to carefully vet through education policy issues so that as we enter the session, particularly a very short session and one that probably is going to move pretty quickly, we're pretty well informed. We already have a head start on where the respective bodies are at in terms of approaching a number of issues. So I think it's great collaboration between the House and Senate in terms of gaining deeper knowledge of pretty difficult policy issues. Today's discussion is going to be actually the first part of two discussions where basically we're trying to set up the legislative session and sort of rewarming our thoughts and our knowledge base around testing, the testing scheme in the state of Minnesota, to have a deeper understanding of the philosophy behind our current testing scheme, the approaches in terms of applying it, and to be able to put our current testing scheme within a context of a broader context of different models, different approaches that may be available to us, and to talk about the pros and cons of those models. As you indicated, Senator, a lot of this, in fact, has been set up by the good work that Senator Rummel and my colleague in the House, Representative Kathy Brainard, who both co-chaired a working group on the state report card, which is not directly on point with our state testing framework, but obviously is related, if you think about it, in terms of Minnesotans asking the question, what is it that we want to know about our schools and we want to know about our students and how that works, and how do we currently measure and weigh that kind of knowledge, and how do we do that within particular frames? And so the report card is not our testing framework in our state, but does really attempt to answer that question for Minnesotans. What is it that we need to know about our schools? It's most helpful, it's most diagnostic in terms of passing better laws, making better policy, and having better practices in our state. And then the obvious question is, so what is the connection between that and what our statewide testing system attempts to measure? What are the overlaps? Are there areas where there aren't overlaps? We quickly can get into some pretty deep stuff, but very important things that speak to the values that Minnesotans hold in terms of education. You ultimately value what you measure, and you measure what you value. And so I'm looking forward to this discussion. I want to thank both Senator Rummel and Representative Brainard for leading that work group during the course of the last few months in terms of the report card that sets up this discussion, this question about its relationship to our statewide testing system. So with that, Senator, I'd turn it back to you.
Oh, thank you. And if legislators at the table could please introduce themselves. Representative Erickson.
I'm Sandra Erickson, representing District 16A and Republican lead.
Lynn Wardlow, I'm from Eagan District 38B. I'm Dean Erdahl. I represent 18B, which is almost all of Meeker County and six townships in Wright County.
Senator Lynch, I represent five school districts, Rochester, Stuartville, Plainview, Elgin, Melville, Dover, Stuartville, and Chatfield.
Senator Terry Bonoff, representing the Minnetonka and Plymouth Medicine Lake area, which encompasses Wayzata, Minnetonka, Hopkins, Robbinsdale, and a little piece of the Osseo School District.
I'm Representative Larry Hosh. I represent District 14B, which is smack dab in the middle of the state, including the school districts of Ricori, Painesville, Avon, St. Cloud, Holdingford, Annandale, Kimball, Eden Valley, Watkins. Yeah, the better half of Eden Valley Watkins. A common joke is I represent the church in Eden Valley, and Representative Erdahl used to represent the adult gentlemen's club in Eden Valley. So the better half.
Okay, Senator Rummel.
Senator Rummel, I represent Mounds View, Centennial, and White Bear Lake area school boards.
Jen Olson, Senate District 33, which is western Hennepin County, including all our parts of eight school districts that are in Hennepin and a little bit in Wright County. Well, some in Carver, too.
I'm Senator Debbie Johnson, and I represent the largest school district in the state, Anoka Hennepin.
Representative John Benson, Minnetonka Plymouth, and I have three school districts, Minnetonka, Hopkins, and Wayzata.
Representative Carolyn Lane from Columbia Heights, Fridley, St. Anthony, and a little bit of Anoka Hennepin.
Representative Kathy Brainerd, I represent the Mankato area with just a tiny little bit of lower North Mankato in my district, and I've had the privilege the last several months of working with Senator Rummel on this project.
Mindy Greiling, Roseville, Lauderdale, St. Anthony Village.
Terry Morrow, I represent St. Peter, Mankato, Nicollet, GFW, Sibley East, and New Ulm school districts.
Hi, I'm Frank Hornstein, and I'm a state representative from the southwest part of the city of Minneapolis.
Ms. Chair. And we have a couple
of others. And I'm Kathy Saltzman, and I represent the South Washington County, Stillwater, and North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale school districts in the East Metro area.
This is the one going off. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I just want to say that it is by design that I asked my GOP colleagues to occupy the left side of the room today. So thank you for that misdirection play.
Okay. We have the agenda before us, and if there is anyone that's not on the agenda that would like to address us, let us know. We'll be as responsive as we can. It's the intent to try to finish by 3, though as Representative Mariani alluded, we'll be having a follow-up meeting on this issue, perhaps additional ones as well as we approach session. Our first testifier is Superintendent Dan Haberman from the Moundsview Public Schools. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm also joined by Mary Roden, who's our assessment coordinator in the district, just in case there may have been some technical questions that I might not be able to address. But again, as I mentioned, it's a pleasure to be here today. By way of introduction, I've been in Moundsview for 33 years. During that time, I've served in a number of roles. School psychologist, special ed coordinator, special ed director, director of curriculum and instruction, deputy superintendent, and superintendent. During that time, the whole issue of student assessment, student evaluation, I've been involved with that in a number of different capacities and a number of different ways in which to look at it. The handout you have before you today, the matrix that we put together, is something that has gone through a number of iterations over the last 5 to 6 years. Its original purpose was as a communication.
Excuse me, Superintendent, make sure, does everyone have this document, assessments? Okay, proceed.
All right. The purpose of it was as a communication tool, both internally with our staff, but also we used it externally with our parent community and with our residents. What we were finding, again, if we would go back 5 to 6 years, is that as there was more and more testing which was being both mandated, if it was through No Child Left Behind and state requirements related to it, or if it was what we were mandating as a district, what we were finding is that all of that was being rolled together. And there was great concern about how much time was being that staff was using in terms of addressing assessment. What did it mean for students as there was more and more assessment? So what we were trying to do with this is we were trying to lay out the different purposes for assessment, the different uses for assessment, to try and clarify some of those issues. And again, in doing that, I think it's served us well from the standpoint of trying to break it apart. And if I would draw your attention to the column in that grid, the second column from the right, where it talks about value added to daily instruction, that's where we really were placing an emphasis. And our purpose today, again, is not in any way to devalue any type of assessment, and it isn't in any way to get into the technical adequacy or inadequacy of any of the instruments. It's simply our version of saying, how does this add to what teachers do on a day-to-day basis with the students in their classroom? And with that said, our district basically follows three really guiding principles when we look at this issue. The first principle is this, and it's, what do we want kids to know? What is it we want kids to learn? That relates to both state standards and state standards as it relates to our local standards. The second point is, how do we know whether or not they have learned what it is that we've identified, what it is that we've prioritized? The third issue is, what do we do if the kids are not progressing? What do we do if we don't see the growth that we want to see? So as we look at all of our assessments, the ones that, again, we have control over, we really look at it from those three perspectives. How do we match it up with what we want to see kids learn? How do we assess on an ongoing basis whether or not it's effective? And what do we do if it's not? That's why the column where we talk about value added to daily instruction is so important. From our perspective, if we can't tie it to what's happening in the classroom, we don't do it. Or we don't do it for long. Because we don't have the time, we don't have the resources to be engaged in work which is not going to be able to enhance that process. So with that as a backdrop, as you look at the grid, in descending order, what we have are what's mandated from the state, what it is that we're required to do, whether it's related, again, to MCAs, it's related to some of the assessments that tie into graduation requirements. And if you look at that, when it says that the value to daily instruction is low, it's because those assessments aren't designed for that purpose. They're designed for your purposes to look at accountability from a state level. But it's important to note that it doesn't have much value to what happens on a day-to-day basis in the classroom. As you go down and look at the T-test or some of the others that are addressing ELL, or English language learners, it's the same issue. They're not designed for that purpose, so they have low value in that regard. As you go to the district level and you look at MAP testing, or if you look at Ames Web, some other things that we use for continuous progress monitoring, you'll see that there's a high value to daily instruction, because what we expect our staff to do is to take the results from those assessments, to meet with their colleagues, to determine how kids are progressing, and look at whether or not instructional strategies need to be adjusted, whether or not they need to look at different aspects of their instructional model to try and impact student learning. The same would hold true with some of the kindergarten and primary level assessments. And on the final page, we get into things such as common assessments, curriculum-based assessments and portfolios. Let me expound on that just a bit. Almost all of those activities are tied into the professional development which takes place within our district. So what we really emphasize with our staff is that when they have professional development time, what they're doing is that they're developing assessments which are unique to their courses. They're developing assessments which are unique to their content area, and that's what we're asking them to use when they're assessing student progress, when they're assessing how students are moving toward the goals that we establish. The cost associated with that, again, if you look in the right-hand column under cost, we say it's incorporated into our professional development plan. A lot of our resources locally are in those areas. One of the challenges we face is if you go back to the top and we're looking at the mandated state testing, and again, I'm not singing the blues. I'm not whining about this. It's a fact that it's costing us approximately $200,000 to $250,000, we estimate, in the administration and management and delivery of the state assessments. Those are dollars that in many ways, if we were able to use those on the assessments that we're generating, curriculum-based common assessments, some of the other work in the areas in which there's a higher degree of correlation with what happens in the classroom, that would be advantageous to us. Now, when I talk about that $200,000 and $250,000, I'm not talking about hardware and technology. I'm talking about Mary's time. I'm talking about the time of other staff in her office. I'm talking about the time it takes for individuals at the site level. I'm talking about the time it takes for our administrators at the site levels. When all of that is pulled together, there's a significant cost associated with that. Whether you think of it as a disconnect or not, that cost is not associated with a classroom impact in terms of direct instruction or the way we are looking at the impact on students. That doesn't say that there isn't some value to the results, but it isn't nearly as great as the impact of the other assessments that we use. And so I just want to make that clear. The other cost that we see as we go down the line is that when there is more online assessment, which is required, we are in sort of an ongoing level of planned obsolescence with technology in our district. Not by design, that's just the way it plays out for us. What we find in our schools is that when we have to pull all of the technology, all of our computers, sort of offline for assessment purposes, it really impacts the amount of time the teachers can use that for instruction. So when those testing windows are open, when those testing days are designated, those are basically days when the students that aren't involved in the assessment really don't have access to technology in many of our schools because of the fact that we don't have the luxury of having that many workstations, that many mobile labs, that many static labs available for them to use as they would at other times. So there are a lot of associated costs, both time costs and monetary costs associated with this. And I know you have a lot on your agenda, so just in summary, what I would like to draw your attention to is, again, as we look at the issue of how does assessment benefit the instruction in the classroom, you can look at this handout in descending order. The further you basically go down the list, the more valuable in categories that is to that purpose. As you look at what the cost is, the cost for us is less as we go down that order because of the fact that we have much of the other work built into what we do on a professional development basis. Whether we have adequate resources for professional development is maybe for another day. But again, that's the point. From a cost of doing the state-mandated assessment, I would just propose one thing for your consideration. That would be a modest amount on a per-student basis to help us and other districts try and deal with some of those costs. We understand why you need the information. We understand state accountability. We endorse accountability. We embrace accountability, maybe more than you do, but we need some assistance, if at all possible, to make that happen. Thank you. I can entertain any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Hornstein, followed by Representative Erickson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the Chair's calling this meeting. This is a huge topic, particularly in my district. We had a number of parents who had a chance to opt out of one of the tests, and when an elementary school in my district had that opportunity, 97% of them did. So clearly there's something going on with this. But I was very intrigued with this developing the site-based assessment that your teachers are involved with. And, you know, my concern is, you know, the amount of time teachers are spending with this and the pedagogical impacts of it. Do you have a sense on some of these other tests that are mandated? Is there a tendency to teach to the test? Is there pressure? I'm not even talking about specifically in your district, but do you either have evidence, anecdotal or otherwise, that this is somehow changing what happens in the classroom in terms of the pedagogy? And is there pressure to teach to a particular test? Or is that a worry or a concern of yours?
Well, the way we've talked about it is that a quality assessment should be taught to. And so as we look at the MAP, for example, and how the MAP assessment aligns with our standards, aligns with state standards, and as we look at our common assessments and some of the curriculum-based assessments that we're using, we work very hard from the top end to work to align those with what we feel is most important. By definition, then, teaching to that test is desirable. That's exactly what we want to see. The time from a professional development perspective that goes into this is that assessment is as important as looking at instructional models and looking at instructional strategies. So we don't break that apart. We put that together as being something that we want to see as a comprehensive portion of our professional development. Now, with regard to, as you get into the MCAs, as you get into the grad exams and that sort of thing, as they go through revisions, that's a little bit more difficult. And again, I think that we've had some questions about that, but there certainly are consistencies but with what's being asked for in those examinations with what we're doing locally. So there's overlap, but some ongoing question about that.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Hoverman, would you just give us a glimpse at what Mounds View was doing in regard to assessment measures pre-2000? I don't know if you used the California assessment, or did you have something that took the place, teacher, for example, of the required testing now that has to be done? And then did you do any site or district-level testing pre-2000?
Superintendent, I think I pronounced it Hoverman, but it's Hooverman, I understand, though you wouldn't know that if you saw it.
No, it's phonetically irregular, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Before 2000, I was trying to think of when we went into the NWEA process, the MAP testing was at about that time. Prior to that, we used the Iowa test of basic skills, and there was a fairly disjointed assessment process in our district. We had curriculum-based assessments in reading and math at the elementary level, a smattering of that at the middle school level. At the high school level, it was exclusively the Iowas, if that was done in 10th grade, which most frequently it was. And it was, but it was a fairly disjointed effort at that time. And it had been troubling to us for quite some time because it was about at that year 2000 when our district started to go through some significant demographic changes also, which meant that we needed a much more unified, much more aligned system.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Follow up, then we'll go to Representative Mariani, followed by Senator Hand.
I'm wondering what would happen if you added another column that would be entitled Parent Response or Parent Involvement. What would that look like as you rate these low, high, et cetera?
I think the assessments that we've been working on, curriculum-based assessments, some of the common assessments, because we've been involved with MAP for as long as we have, I think that a majority of our parent community has seen the value of that. They've heard enough about that I think that we would get probably I would estimate maybe a two-thirds, three-quarter positive parental response from that. I think in some of the other areas it might be less clear. And again, I think this is a real challenge to try and communicate what's on this handout on a consistent basis, to talk about the value and talk about the purpose of the various assessments. So, but again, I think that we've been at it long enough that we would see a majority of people seeing. And again, as we communicate with parents, we really try and show them how this can be beneficial to their child, how it can be beneficial to them, how it's beneficial to the teacher. But that's a good suggestion.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take two remaining questions. Representative Mariani, followed by Senator Hand.
Thank you, Senator, and Superintendent Hooverman. Two questions, because Representative Erickson triggered one, but I'll try to make this real quick. So, continuing along that theme, how important do you think it is for the public's sense of ownership and confidence in what you do and what your colleagues do in your school district? How important is it to be able to distinguish for them the difference of these assessments, and to be able, as opposed to attempting to tell one story all wrapped up in one, involving all of these different levels of assessments?
For us, it's been critical for this reason. About 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what we made a concerted effort to do was to make sure that our parents, particularly at the middle school level, had a clear understanding with the MAP assessment what the goals were going to be, individual goals were going to be for their child. And as we became more sophisticated in how we shared that information and the parents understood what those goals represented, we saw a spike in student performance, because it became more clear to them what the expectation was in terms of the growth that we were expecting each year. And we had always had that feeling and had seen some effect of that at the elementary level. We were pleasantly surprised by the impact it had at the middle school. So I think that understanding is absolutely critical.
Well, and Superintendent Hooverman, and I'll try to be quick again, and this could get us into a much longer conversation, but I think part of that, the answer is in the answer you just gave. I was struck by, and I really appreciate the matrix. It's very helpful. Thank you. I was struck by the interpretation of it, the reality of it, that as you move down the matrix here, the cost is less because you've built into your professional development, what you would be doing anyway, costs into those assessments. And so, just hearing that in the previous answer, that makes a whole lot of sense, because that, in other words, that's exactly, those assessments yield exactly what is of value to your stakeholders, if you will. Here's the big question, and you don't have to fully get into it. We'll probably fully get into it more as the hearing goes along. What is the one single, and there ain't one single, but inherent flaw with the in this regards with the assessments at the upper end of this matrix I don't want to get into the cost thing, but what is the one single thing that doesn't work for your stakeholders in regards to the to those state level assessments requirements?
Well, and again, it's not, this response won't be in regard to the technical adequacy of the assessment and that sort of thing. What the real issue is the timeliness of the information and the timeliness of the results.
Right.
The assessments, as you go in a descending order on the matrix, the most powerful part of that is how quickly that information gets back to the hands of the teachers, gets back to the students, and gets to the parents. The greater the delay, the greater the lag in that feedback cycle, the greater or the less the impact it can have in the instructional process. For example, with our common assessments at our high school, we purchased a software package which allows the teachers to give those assessments on a Tuesday, have the results scanned that day, either get the results later in the day or the next day. If they had to wait a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or 5 months to get those results, it would be of no benefit to them. So the timeliness of the results being available to teachers, students, and parents, I think, is the most critical variable.
Thank you.
Sir Hinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just briefly, and Superintendent Hooverman, thank you for coming today, and we appreciate the information. I wanted to just make sure I understand your critique here or your assessment of the assessments in your matrix. And in hearing your presentation and reading through the material, you seem to be pretty clear that the value of testing seems to be greater when it's applied at the lower level site and district level rather than the kinds of testing that's mandated or required by states, that those have value only insofar as they meet the requirements of the federal government or the state. And I question if that's really, if am I hearing that correctly, because it would seem to me that there is value, I would think, in not only knowing that students are progressing, but also that they are performing adequately against some standard, whatever it might be, a statewide test standard or some norm, so that you can tell parents not only is your child progressing, but is also at a grade level that that child should be at or at a place in their learning where they should be at. And further, as they get into the high school years, that they are at a stage of learning so that they will graduate with the kind of body of knowledge that a high school graduate would be expected to have. And isn't that information of value, and isn't that also useful in planning curriculum at grade levels to make sure that that happens? And so I guess I want some clarification on your assessment of the value of the state testing, whether it may not be constructed precisely correctly, and I can certainly understand that, but I'm a little bit disturbed by the take that these tests have value only insofar as they meet the requirements of some administrative body that just wants to get the data. I think the value of the testing was supposed to be to give parents and others the assurance that the children are getting educated, and I would think that you as an educator in a school district would be interested in that, but you seem to say, no, that's not really your interest, and could you clarify that?
Well, to your last point, we do have an interest in that. And the critical variable in assessing the value is in what impact for this exercise has been what is its value to daily instruction. As you look at the matrix and we talk about the MCA, other state mandate assessments, we don't say that they're of no value. That isn't the point. They're of low value when it comes to what teachers do day to day. We do look at the results when we get them in July or August or September or October or November. What it is, though, is that's information from the previous year. Our planning takes place for the 08-09 school year. A bulk of our planning is done in May, June, July, into August. And if we don't have the information, it's difficult even to incorporate it. When we do get it, we incorporate it, we look at that. We're very interested in how our students are performing in relationship to other students in the state. But when you look at that in terms of adjustments we're going to make in our instructional model, at our schools, when we're going to look at how teachers at a various school are going to look at groupings of students, how best to deliver instruction. It's of lower value. But we're not saying that it's of no value. And our litmus test on that is what's happening in the classroom. So, again, we want to look at that. That's why we use the MAP assessments. We get a picture of how our students are comparing. So many districts in Minnesota are using that. That gives us another view. Nationally, that gives us another view. So, we're very interested in that. That would be a slightly different standard.
Good. Thank you. And Ms. Broden, anything you'd like to add?
Thank you again for the opportunity to be here today. And I just want to reiterate the comprehensive assessment system that Moundsview is using and the worthiness that our teachers in the classroom are showing by using these tools to better look at the impact of instruction on their students and how to better address their needs.
Thanks. We will take one final question on this segment. Representative Dietrich.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late, and you might have addressed this. I look at this spreadsheet, and I am alarmed by something that when you spend a lot of time and money administering something that a school district might feel, and I would have to say I would feel the same. I have three teenage boys, that has a low impact on the students, but yet a high impact on the school. That there is a dichotomy there that is troubling. And so, I'm not saying that you're taking this approach, but instead of myself taking the approach of, well, why don't we dissect this? Why don't we get rid of it? Why don't we do something? Because I would agree with Representative Erickson. This, for example, the MCAs do provide some meaningful information for parents. Time lag, yes. Anything that I do on a daily basis, no. But it gives me a general framework for my child, which I do appreciate. But so what can we do, if anything, to change that low to high on impact for students?
Maybe nothing.
That's right.
Because the intent is different. The intent of looking, in my judgment, the intent of what the MCAs do from a state perspective is different. It doesn't mean that it's good or bad. It's different. I think what I would suggest, if I could be so bold as to say this, is what's the amount of resource that's going into that level versus the resources that conceivably could be available to local districts for the other levels. But the purpose of the assessment is different. It's not intended to benefit instruction. That's why it has low value, we believe, in terms of what happens day to day. I don't think you can construct assessment that is going to meet the accountability needs across the state that can be a diagnostic instrument at the local level on a frequent basis. You can't do it. So it's different purposes, that's what this is trying to point out. But what is the time cost? What's the resource cost that goes into that would be a consideration.
Thank you very much, especially also the handouts. Very good preparation in that. And if there's any additional suggestions that you have, please share that with each of our committees as we prepare for session.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item 2, overview of growth and value-added models, Dr. Jim Angermeyer. And Doctor, if you early in the presentation could include a very brief distinction, a coffee shop distinction between growth and value, especially helpful for door-to-door for the House and as we discuss this in the with a lot of people, and we appreciate the preparation that you put into this presentation.
Thank you, Senator. And I should say that I'm here today as a substitute for Dr. Mark Davison, a kind of a last-minute substitute, so... Okay. So I have the luxury, or at least the excuse, I guess, of saying that I haven't had a chance to prepare a lengthy PowerPoint presentation or any handout. So I'm going to try to confine my comments to a few brief things about just the topic you noted, and be happy to take some questions.
Thanks.
The staff did email me some questions that they would like me to address, including that one. Let me just say, by way of credentials, I'm the director of research and evaluation in the Bloomington Public Schools. I've been there for 10 years, and I've actually been involved in this study and measure of student achievement growth for about the last 15 years. Many of your districts use the Northwest Evaluation Association's tests, the measures of academic progress. I think there's over 350 districts now in Minnesota that use that. But in 1991, there was only one, and it was Representative Wardlow's district, Apple Valley, Rosemount, Eagan, when I was the director of research and evaluation there. So that was long before computerized assessment. We did most of the testing on paper and pencil, but the idea of measurement, measuring student growth was very appealing to teachers even back then. And I think with the advent of No Child Left Behind, that appeal has actually grown rather than diminished. So I think what I'd like to do is, if I could talk about the idea of growth, student achievement growth, what a growth model is, what it requires to have a growth model, expand that a little bit into what value added means relative to growth.
Please.
And then talk a little bit about what the what legislation you passed in the past seems to address.
And this is your handout?
I don't have a handout, no, sir.
Department, perhaps.
I'm going to use that one. Growth is appealing to teachers, as you know, because in any classroom, in any school, the variation in student achievement is very large. The variation within a grade is always much larger than the average difference across grades. And teachers know that they have students that come to them with different levels of skill. Sometimes are working 2 or 3 years below grade level, and sometimes 2 or 3 years above grade level. What teachers feel accountable for is making sure students in their class, during the time that they have them, make progress. And so if you happen to have a class that has a very large number of low-achieving students, if they came to them low, then when they're held accountable and tested against standards, they are often going to find themselves having many students below standards, even though the students within their class may have made significant progress. And likewise, teachers who have a lot of students above grade level, they may in fact have all of their students reaching that standard, but the growth may have been less. So that the notion of growth just has an intuitive appeal to teachers. And there are some educators that think that should be the main currency of our accountability. I don't think that's necessarily true, and I think Dr. Heist is going to talk about the relationship between growth and status and how obviously they're related and how you wouldn't want to have an accountability system that focused just on one and not the other. In order to have growth, there are some criteria. First of all, you need some way to link the content from 1 year to the next, or some way in a measurement scale to tell whether a student has made progress from 1 year to the next. We have had in the past a state assessment system that had a scale score within a grade. There is no way, there has been no way to relate the score on that scale from 1 year to the next. Being proficient in third grade and being proficient in fourth grade may mean a different amount of change than going from proficient in sixth grade to seventh grade. And that has to do just with the way the standards are set and the way the within grade scale is built. So in order to measure growth, what you really need is some kind of a tool that like a ruler, measures height from year to year. And I like to use that height analogy a lot when I'm describing this. Those of you that took your children to the pediatrician when they were young, remember the growth and height chart that the physician would display. And it would show a line graph, usually, that on one axis showed the age of the child and the other axis either their height or their weight. The way that your child moved along that line is simply growth. And in achievement growth, we try to measure the same sort of thing. So a growth model, and growth is nothing more than the measurement of change from 1 year to the next. Value added, on the other hand, I would say is a way to attribute cause of growth. And I think the biggest difference between growth and value added is that attributional piece. What caused this growth to happen?
Restate that once more.
Well, I would say the difference between growth and value added is the difference between the measurement of change versus the attribution of that change. What caused that change to happen? A value added model will by definition always have to have growth as a piece of it. In other words, you can't attribute value to something in growth if you don't have growth measure in it. But the reverse isn't true. You can have growth without a value added. And let me explain. So if you go back to my growth and height chart for a child, you can say that your child went from 7 pounds at age at birth to 14 pounds at 8-9 months. And that tells you growth. It tells you how much change happened during that time. It doesn't tell you anything about the attribution of that or the value of that. So if I told you that your child went from the 10th percentile to the 50th percentile during that same period of time, now you have some sort of a relationship between the growth that child had and other children. So from growth, you can go from just simply measuring growth to describing how much growth did this child produce compared to other kids. And Dr. Heisted is going to describe a growth model that looks at a normative amount of growth. We can talk about how much change did this child make compared to other children, and we can aggregate that together to talk about how much growth did this group of children make compared to what we would expect to happen for a group of children in the third grade. The next step to value added then is to try to control for those conditions that lead to growth and say growth was probably caused by, and depending on the model you use, you could say things like growth was caused by being in this school because this school produces more growth for its kids than this school. Or you could say growth was caused by this curriculum because we know that schools that use this curriculum seem to produce more growth than schools that don't use this curriculum. Or we can say that growth was caused by this teacher because we have a history of information that says this teacher has consistently caused more growth to happen than this. And all of those models generally are statistical, and they generally require lots of control of all the variants and a lot of data in order to be able to answer that kinds of question. So the value-added piece, again, is the attribution. What is it that we think caused this growth to happen, and what effect was
it? Sarah Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Angermeyer, if I said that correctly.
That's correct.
Where does the standard come into that model? So I think, you know, one of the questions that Representative Dietrich raised with regard to the value of the MCA-2s compared to this is the standard is embedded in the MCA-2s. Is there an approach that gives us the value add, which I think is critical, as well as compares it to achieving the standard?
There are models like that. I think the Assistant Commissioner is going to talk in her presentation about growth towards standards. And so you can describe a line, as we do with the MCAs, that says we want all students by fifth grade to be at this point, or seventh grade. We know the student is here in third grade. We know we have 2 years to get from this point to this point. How can we describe the necessary amount of growth to reach that target? And it might be just saying if it's this far, we're going to divide it up by the number of years, and the student has to grow this much each year. It may turn out that that's twice as much growth as is typical for normal third graders to fifth graders, in which case you'd be having a very high standard or a very high expectation of growth. But that's the way you describe growth towards a standard.
Follow up.
Sarah Bonoff.
When I refer to standard, I'm also looking at curriculum standards, which are in every grade level. Mm-hmm. So not, you know, getting from this point at grade 3 to that point at grade 5, but a comparative with regard to curriculum standards.
By curriculum standards?
That we know it in grade 3, we want students to be, you know, reading at this level and doing. So I want to see both. How are they doing compared to that standard at a point in time, as well as how are they progressing?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to describe.
Okay.
I wouldn't call them curriculum standards. I would call them performance standards.
Okay, thank you.
And they're reflected by the standards, the scales that are set by the state on those tests.
Okay.
So when you reach level 3 on our tests, which is meet proficiency, we're saying that that's the expectation we have, the minimal expectation we have of students in fourth grade or in fifth grade.
Okay.
And with the testing we do, we can describe where the student is in an absolute sense, on that scale, like our ruler that measures height, how far they are from that.
Good. Thank you.
Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Angermeyer, appreciate your being here and your testimony. One of the comments you made, you said, I've got it essentially correct, but you said the variation of achievement or ability within a grade, the variation is greater than you'd find in the difference of achievement between one grade and another. Or did I capture that essentially correct?
That's
correct. And I think that's my gut is that's true. I think that it's correct. But my question is, why do we do that? That variation find within the grade itself and say let's disperse that variation so that you have, regardless of students' age, students grouped more by ability or achievement level rather than by age. Why wouldn't we do that?
Well, I think some schools have tried to do that, and there might be some value in that. When I say the variation, it's important to know that that variation changes when we talk about different subjects. For example, a student may be a very weak reader and be on the low end of that distribution, but a very strong math student and on the high end of the distribution. So if you were going to follow your model, what you would have to do is throughout the day shuffle kids and constantly group them according to the students that are like them. Because the variation is so large, you're also looking at, you know, an age mixture sometimes that just doesn't make practical sense. I think my experience has been, the research says, and I think schools have found that when they tried to, for example, keep some students back, the idea that you can't go from eighth grade to high school until you're a proficient high school student, what you end up with is warehouses of kids that are between middle school and high school that don't want to go anywhere. And most districts, Chicago being a good example, that have tried that have since abandoned it. So it has a logical appeal where you'd group kids by ability instead of age, and it doesn't always work as well as one would think.
Interesting. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Angermeyer, I wanted to ask you maybe to elaborate a little bit on the value-added definition you used. You said it was attribution of change or cause. Could there be another way to look at value-added simply statistically? If you look at growth as the change in the student's performance from one place to another, and then look at value-added as the relationship between the individual student's growth and a growth norm, could you consider that value added totally independently of any attribution of cause?
Well, I think it definitely could, and Dr. Heisen's going to describe that model. I would still say that implied in there, maybe not explicit, but implied is that you're attributing that growth to the experience of that school year. Statistical models, the statistical value-added models that you've heard about from Dr. William Sanders, for example, they very explicitly model the effects. So they would be able to tell you, this is the effect that's caused by the grade level, this is the effect caused by the school, this is the effect caused by the teacher. In the model you're describing, you're saying, here's where the student started this school year. Here's where the student ended that school year. This is the amount of growth that occurred. This is the amount of growth we expected. The student exceeded that, and there's an implied, therefore, we assume that the school caused that growth to happen. You don't have to attribute it to that, but implicitly, that's what we're saying.
Just to follow up, my only point was that you could just, you could define it statistically without the attribution, even if the attribution is implied.
I would agree.
Okay. Right. Okay, noted. Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Angermeyer, a long time ago, you spoke to a group of us teachers about testing, and you just reminded me how good you were, and that Bloomington's gain is definitely 196's loss. But in fact, we have people, I talked to people today once in a while, say, remember Dr. Angermeyer? Yeah, we really screwed up and let him go. Anyway, I just thought I'd give you a
where are we going here?
Is there a way? See, I think part of the value is a teacher itself, and I know some teachers make kids learn better than others. It's just the way it is. Some people just do it differently for different kids. Has Bloomington or some other school figured out a way to track a kid throughout a sequence of years, and then find out that no matter what kind of kids this teacher has, because some years you get a really smart class and sometimes you have a really fun but not so smart class, you know, it's just the nature of it. Is there a way to track, you know, it seems like whenever Mrs. So-and-so, all her kids, they don't always grow the most, but compared to others, but they always grow more. And so is there a way to track that? Because that would be nice to know.
Senator,
is there a way?
Representative Wardle, thank you for the compliment. I appreciate that. I think most of the research on teacher effects shows just what you described, that of all of the variables we look at in school, whether it's curriculum or school calendar or dollars spent, anything else, teacher effects almost always trump all the rest of those. And like variation in students, there are variations in teachers. Some teachers are more skilled at producing growth than others. But what we've also found is that schools work best when they're sort of this organic system where for some students you need the effect of both a good special education teacher and a good classroom teacher. And in combination, they produce growth. And it's difficult to tease out which one caused more and which one caused less. We know that young teachers aren't as effective as older teachers. Particularly in the first couple of years, teachers are oftentimes just... I have a daughter, by the way, who's teaching at Lakeville now. She's a first-year teacher, and I feel sorry for her students. But I think she'll get better. There are ways to track that, but again, I don't know that there's value. For us as a district, we don't do that. We track the progress of students within the school, and we ask the schools and the grade levels to look at the growth they're producing and to set improvement goals if they're not producing growth and to target individual students to achieve more growth. But we do not try to, at this district level anyway, parcel out that effect due to any individual teacher.
One follow-up, and then Representative Mariani will conclude questions for this testifier.
By the way, my wife teaches at Lakeville, so I'll have to later. But one of the reasons I was broaching that subject is because if you can find out who the good teachers are, maybe you can clone them. You know, because I used to watch a good teacher, and I'd say, "What are you doing that I'm not doing?" You know. And try to share the wealth, and that was one of the purposes of my question.
Okay, thank you very much for your eloquent testimony, Representative Mariani. Excuse
me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm actually wrestling with a question that my staff asked me to ask, and I think it's a good question. But before I do that, and this might be a better question of. It will be a good question for the next testifier, but from your perspective, Dr. Engelmeyer, what are we currently in law requiring in regards to growth and value added?
I think that most of the language that I've seen related to that is in Statute 120B.35, the Student Academic Achievement Progress, and it talks in there under subsection 3 that the commissioner must identify effective models for measuring individual student progress. And I would say that I think has been done this year with the introduction of the what's called a vertical scale score that links the MCA tests from year to year by subject so that there is a common scale that can be applied to measure change from year to year. It also goes on to say that at least one of these models must be a value-added assessment model. So the legislation does seem to distinguish between a tool that measures the growth and reports the growth of an individual student from a value-added model. And it says that it must estimate the effects of classroom settings where a single teacher teaches multiple subjects. I think the value-added language from conversations we've had was probably introduced following testimony from Dr. Sanders that talked about a specific type of statistical model, and that's confusing. Later on in that same section, there's some language that talks about the commissioner must implement a value-added assessment program to assist school districts, public schools, and charter schools. the program must assess individual students' academic achievement over time. So it sounds to me like when I read it that there's kind of a blending of those two terms of growth and value added.
Yep.
I think that to the extent that can be clarified, it would be helpful.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's my understanding of the history of it. And frankly, I mean, I continue to I'm not a psychometrician or a deep student of these methodologies, but I was using those interchangeably, a year ago. And I think the legislature is increasingly adding to its knowledge base and beginning to understand the distinction. And part of that is also we've had, I think, the development of the field, to provide interpretation for us. And so the legislature, one point here for our members is that to some degree this isn't a new struggle for us as a legislature. I think we've identified going back at least a couple of years that there are pretty distinctive approaches here, and we've struggled with how to understand them, how to incorporate them, and we've obviously asked our Department of Education to come back to us with a deeper understanding and some possible ways in which to incorporate these approaches. My staff had a very interesting question. I hope I had this right, but I kind of like it. And my staff asked about, for instance, the example where a student pursues AP courses. And, I know with my kids, some of that was driven by the fact that I told them I think they ought to be doing that. And how do we control in a value-added model for those kind of influences and those factors in terms of student choices? Because there's in that particular example there's a lot of studies that show, high prevalence of college going, college success related to AP test or AP course taking in K-12. Is it the goal of a value-added is it the goal of a value-added model to attempt to control for all those factors, or is that just sort of part of what we need to decide? What are the most important factors, perhaps framed up by what we have control of inside the K-12 schools? Maybe you can just say a little bit about, can they sort of just meld into too much stuff and it's not even useful for us anymore? Or?
Well, first of all of the models you hear are going to talk more about our abilities and our ability to measure growth at the elementary school and maybe in the middle school.
Okay.
All of those things tend to fall apart by the time we get to high school, which is where AP courses and
because of the choices. And,
yeah. Partly because of the measures are less frequent, partly because of the gap between, to measure growth, you got to have 2 points in time, and we stop testing, for instance, reading in eighth grade, and then we don't test it again until 10th grade, okay. And maths even later. So the ability to do value added in high school is challenging, and most of the models that you'll see around the country focus on elementary and middle school. Regarding what you can control for, again, the statistical models are very robust, and if you have enough students and enough data, you can control for almost anything. The simpler the model, the easier it is to explain and the easier it is to understand and compute. Dr. Heistad's going to talk about a model that only attempts to control for prior achievement. So we only are going to talk about how much did students grow relative to where they started and relative to other students who started at the same spot. Some models control for race and ethnicity. Control for the percentage of poverty within the school. Some models. I think the effect of those is, from a research standpoint, you get a more precise estimate of the effects of that school when you control for all the other variants. In a practical sense, what you get is you get sort of different expectations for different groups of kids. Mm-hmm. So when you start saying, the student grew compared to other students who had the same prior achievement, member of the same ethnic group, also having free reduced lunch, who also went to this school, you might have a very good accountability, but you've sort of changed the standards for different kids. I think that's the argument about how much you should control for.
Thank you.
We have a couple of members that have to leave before 3, and we did have a request if Dr. Heisted could speak no later than 2:30, and so we're going to try to adjust the agenda accordingly. Thank you, Dr. Engmeyer, and we'll go to item 3 for the Department of Education. Then we'll go to Dr. Heisted at 2:30. Welcome.
Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner Christy Hovanitz-Lasilla.
Christy Hovanitz-Lasilla.
Okay.
I was requested to
Could you move the mic up and thanks.
Requested to discuss two particular things. One was the U.S. Department of Education requirements for a growth model under No Child Left Behind for adequate yearly progress calculations. And then second, a model that we had designed for Minnesota that we...
Excuse me, could you a little closer to the mic?
That we will be proposing to the U.S. Department of Education. Is it on?
Let's try another mic.
Yeah. Okay. Does this one work better?
She's got not if your voice isn't.
You got to put your mouth right on.
You can hold it. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, much better.
There you go.
Two topics to talk about. One, requirements or the framework that we are operating under within the No Child Left Behind growth model. And then two, the work that we have done to propose an application to be submitted to the U.S. Department of Education. So I'll do a primer and overview of how we got to where we are right now, walk through the framework that No Child Left Behind requires for a growth model, and then discuss the Minnesota's proposed application. Dr. Engmeyer did a good job of explaining why use a growth model versus value-added model. Right now, AYP calculations currently only discuss proficiency and whether or not students have met a proficient status. A growth model rewards schools for moving students towards proficiency even though they might not actually attain proficiency yet. And I think Dr. Heisted's model and Dr. Engmeyer's discussion was to have an accountability system that only accounted for proficiency was missing half the conversation, that you needed to be able to measure growth as well. For the model that we are going to be proposing and what No Child Left Behind requires is all of the current rules we have in place for adequate yearly progress right now will remain in place. Nothing will change. So this model that we're proposing will only help additional schools. In no way can it prevent a school from meeting AYP under the current requirements. AYP will only be computed for those schools that do not meet the status or the proficiency index and or do not meet the safe harbor calculation. So in no way will this negatively impact schools. Just a quick timeline. Back in December, Secretary Spellings reopened the growth model pilot. The following week, we met with the Minnesota Assessment Group and gathered a group of volunteers to work on this growth application model. We met twice. In January, the secretary extended 2 weeks our deadline, so it's now February 15th. We've presented our application and growth model to the Minnesota Assessment Group, the Commissioner's Accountability and Assessment Stakeholders Group, and also to our local assessment and advisory committee for input and comment. Our application's due on February 15th. If we meet the Brightline principles that they've outlined, they will send it to peer review in March. It'll be actually reviewed and comments back in April, and we'd be able to use this calculation in August or for our 2008 calculations. The members of our work group include two of our presenters today, as well as the Department of Education. So we had six different districts working on this on a volunteer basis. Our tasks were to review the growth models that were currently accepted by the U.S. Department of Education and those that weren't accepted, so we knew the comparison. We discussed the pros and cons and the possibility of implementing each of these different types of growth models in Minnesota, and then we selected the best growth model options in Minnesota for determining growth and still meeting or maintaining those bright line principles, and then discussed the calculation rules for the growth model application. The Department of Education has laid out 7 very explicit bright line principles that must be met in order to be considered for a growth model. And as Dr. Engelmeyer explained the difference between growth and value added, we are focusing purely on growth. The U.S. Department of Education is assuming the implicit attribution of this growth to the school. So this is purely a growth model and assuming that all of the value that is added to the student growth is done by the school. We still have to ensure that all of our students are proficient by 2014 to ensure that we're closing the achievement gaps, that all students reach them. We have to set expectations for annual achievement for base grade line proficiency that cannot be adjusted or controlling for race, background, or other school characteristics. So we have to set the same standard for all students. We still have to hold students accountable in math and reading. It cannot be a compensatory model where reading performance can help for low math performance or vice versa. We still have to ensure that all students and test grades are included, so we still have to have 95% tested, and we have to have the subgroups represented for each of our growth models. We will be including all of our assessments in 3 through 8 in high school, and they've been operational for more than 1 year, so that makes us eligible to be able to apply for the growth model. And our results are now comparable from year to year as we now have our vertical scale. And we are also able to track progress for schools or for students in the state, so we do have that established longitudinal data system that we are continuing to build and gather additional data requirements for. And we still have to have a separate indicator for participation and for achievement, so they can't be combined again for those two measures. In addition to these 7 bright line principles that we must meet with regard to the AYP growth model, there are several other nuanced or caveats that they have as requirements that they don't consider bright line principles. We have to maintain the same end size, so we have to have 40 students or 20 students, we can't have a different cell size for each of our subgroups. We cannot use confidence intervals. We cannot use multi-year averaging in our growth model. We can still maintain those attributes for our status and our safe harbor calculations, but we cannot use those in our growth calculations. We have to be able to use this model across grades, so it will transition from middle to high school and from elementary to middle school. And we will still have to, if we get approved for this growth model, show how the growth model impacted our schools compared to a regular calculation for AYP.
Assistant Commissioner, in the longitudinal growth model, is it on the individual student or just students in that class, or both?
Individual students.
And you're able to track that student? What type of identifier do you use?
We currently use a MARS identifier. And it's the student ID. It's assigned by the district. And we have gone to probabilistic matching routines that allow us to match on not just students' last name, first name, MARS identification, date of birth, grade, and able to track students from 1 year to the next and create a common record for that student over multiple years.
Thank you.
These are some of the different growth model approaches that we discussed and that different states are using. Improvements, a measure that we're already using, and it's a quasi-growth measure. It's looking at the decrease in percent proficient, the decrease in the percent not proficient from 1 year to the next. It's already inherent in our AYP model. We looked at a trajectory model, which looks at our students making segmented growth towards proficiency over a set number of years. Looked at value table models, which is the model that we have or are going to be proposing. We looked at projection models, or what's the probability of a student to be proficient in several years, some linear equating, residual gain scores, and multi-level modeling. We did not spend a lot of time on the last three because those models have not been accepted by the U.S. Department of Education. And the projection models that we looked at, we do not have enough longitudinal student data yet to determine the validity of those projections. So we would not be able to get something like that approved yet at the department.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Mariani.
Just very quickly, not so much a question, but a quick comment, and we could pick it up later. I know we want to keep moving. But for me, the thing that I hear then with the bright line principles given down by the federal government is that partly our hands are tied in this state in terms of being able to consider the full range of possibilities for an effective growth model based on the things that we care about in this state. And, you know, I'm just, you and I will visit because, I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. And I'm thinking in particular about EOL students. You know, where do they factor in on all this? And EOL students is exactly where a lot of the NCLB current expectations begin just to fall apart. But anyway, we need to get through. You don't need to comment now. You and I will visit, and we'll continue this discussion. But for me, I think it's safe to say and to acknowledge, you know, flat out here, that the federal government, in many ways, I mean, this is better than what we currently have, but in many ways has already, established a pretty tight corridor down which we're going to have to walk through in order to get to a growth model that they'll accept. And whether or not that reflects what we want to be able to have come out of our assessment system is a real big question for us. So.
May I comment?
Sure.
I agree. There are very finite principles that the U.S. Department of Education is requiring. However, I do know that their end goal is proficiency by 2014. And so they do have a lot of parameters for us to achieve that goal. I do not think that Minnesota should be limited to one specific growth model. I think this particular growth model is what can be used for school accountability purposes in order to meet those bright line principles, but I don't think that in any way should constrict or limit what we do at the state level with regard to state level accountability, informing instruction, determining teacher effectiveness, or any other things that we want to look at with regard to value added specifically or growth in and of itself. So I do think that within the constraints of the U.S. Department, we are limited in what we can do. But I think there are some options for how we can do that, aside from things that we should be doing at the state level, not connected to AYP. And this is a conversation that most states are having right now. I had the opportunity to meet with about 30 states the last 2 days surrounding this particular issue. And most states that I have been talking to or working with have multiple growth measures or models. They'll have one model for teacher effectiveness. They'll have one model for determining program effectiveness or policy effectiveness. They'll have a different model completely for their state accountability system and yet another model for adequate yearly progress. And in most states, because of the function of the growth models or the goal that they're trying to achieve, they don't conflict. With regard to AYP, this will be a rather transparent calculation. When you look at the school report card, you're going to see the same information with regard to the AYP calculation. Did they meet their proficiency? Did they meet Safe Harbor? And then did they meet growth? So it's did they meet their math target? And it will show the three different ways they can meet their math target. Did they meet their reading target? And show the three different ways they can meet their reading target. So it could be a rather transparent calculation with regard to how we implement it for school accountability purposes, specifically for AYP.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you could try to abbreviate in the next wrap-up, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and then we'll go to Dr. Eistedt.
Sure. Our proposed model is we are actually looking at a value table approach to our model. The reason why is it's going to be a continuous implementation. We'll be able to use it across the MCA2, the MTEL, and the MTAS, so all three of our assessments can be used in the same model. And it will be a continuous model when we transition from the MCA2 to MCA3 in 2011. So there are some benefits for using a value table model like this. Essentially, one of the other bright line principles that wasn't explicitly stated, but it comes out in peer review, is they want us to be able to look at continuous improvement or the use of more than 2 years of data. And in 2008, we will have our 3 years of data. We'll have 06, 07, and 08 data, and we want to be able to include all of that information in an individual student's score. So this is an example of what a value table looks like. You notice that we have four achievement levels for our MCA2, MTEL, and MTAS. We have a does not meets category, a partially meets, and meets expectation, and a meets and exceeds expectations. You see here that we have five different categories, and they're broken out a little bit different. We have a does not meet category that's low, and a does not meet category in high. This was determined that we want to be able to demonstrate that low-performing students are making growth even within their category. And this was split based on students that are basically guessing or are responding by chance versus those that are actually responding. We also split apart the partially meets category to demonstrate that they are making progress towards proficiency, even though they're not moving out of that level. You notice the meets and exceeds categories are lumped together. One of the requirements for No Child Left Behind is high-performing students or growth of high-performing students cannot compensate for that of a low-performing student. So we cannot award additional points or extra credit for students moving from meets to exceeds to compensate for a student that is still in the does not meets category. So you'll see those two lumped together. And this is USDE's way of saying that we want you to meet the bright line principle of all students proficient by 2014. And I see this is probably where the state accountability system will differ from the federal accountability system, given that we will want students moving from that meets to exceeds category and reward them for that performance. Just a quick example of how this will work. This is a student. They started in 2006 and does not meet low. In 2007, they moved up to does not meets high. And in 2008, they moved to partially meets low. So you'll see this student showed two consecutive years of growth, but yet they're still not proficient. These values were included just for demonstration purposes, but it shows that a student who was in does not meet high in the prior year, which is down the left-hand side, across by the current year. So you can show a student that is in does not meet high in the columns going down, walks across to the partially meets low, and earns 40 points for their school. Because this is the second consecutive year of that student's growth, we will add additional points or compounding points because they've made two consecutive years of growth. So what we'll do is we'll look at the does not meets low or does not meets high to the partially meets low, and they're awarded 40 points. But we also want to give them more credit because it's the second consecutive year of growth. So we take the difference between the points at the next highest category and the partially meets low category points to give them 15 additional points. So we want to give them more credit because they've compounded for 2 years of growth, but we don't want to give them as much credit as if they would have actually moved up into that next higher achievement level. So this student would effectively earn 55 points. I explained the difference or why we've moved away from the four growth categories. So for example, for an entire school, this is be a school with 250 students. The red numbers are students that made that performance. So you see in the upper left-hand corner, there were 5 students that started the prior year in does not meets low. Next year, they're still in does not meets low. Last year, there were 10 students that were in does not meets low that moved up to does not meets high, and then 5 students that were in does not meets low that moved up to partially meets low. So what we're doing is we're looking at each individual student movement and aggregating that for the particular school. So the red numbers that you see here are the number of students taken from the previous table, and the blue numbers are the values that were assigned to those movements. So student that moves from does not meet low to does not meet high earns 40 points for that school. 10 students accomplish that, so they earn 400 points for that school. We'll go through and we will aggregate all the students and the points for that particular school and then divide by the total number of students, as you see down below in the total points category, to get a growth score of 66.4. This growth score will be compared to our current statewide targets for our percent proficient. So if the growth score, the movement of those students, meets or exceeds what we've already established as our proficient, proportion proficient scores in our current accountability workbook, that school will be considered to make growth. So in a nutshell, abbreviated version.
Yes.
Okay. That's how a value table would work. The information behind developing a value table is a little bit more complicated than the actual application of the value table. Once the value table is established, it's very easy for a school or a teacher to calculate the individual values for their class or for their school. It's flexible with regard to grader subject. We can develop separate tables for reading and math for elementary, middle, and high, and it allows us to focus on our educational goals using empirical analysis to determine the values, but then valuing movement two levels more than we would value a movement for just one level of performance. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. We will be revisiting this, as I mentioned earlier, and we appreciate your excellent handouts as well.
Thank you.
And is this available online?
We can make it available online.
Yeah, it might be helpful on your website, or at least I'd like to get that, the electronic version. Maybe other members would. Okay, and Senator Rummel has that, so.
No, your staff has
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah, then I'll get that from them.
Thank you.
Dr. Heistad. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator Weiger and Representative Mariani. Legislators, my name is Dave Heistad. I'm the Executive Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment in Minneapolis Public Schools. And there are two main areas that I'd like to address today. One is a brief summary of the growth model that is proposed for the school report cards. And the second is a comment about the assessments. I'll start with the assessments first. As Dr. Hooverman mentioned, districts use multiple assessments for different purposes. And Minneapolis is very similar to Mounds View and Bloomington in that we've been using the NWA assessments now for 10 years. We were right after Egan Apple Valley in terms of implementation of the NWA. Unfortunately, like our suburban counterparts, or unlike our suburban counterparts, we can't afford the measure of academic progress, the MAP. So we're using Jim's version in Bloomington that he developed, which does the same thing. We're very pleased with the ability then to not only have measures of the standards through the MCAs, but also measures of growth. Because when you're talking about distinguishing schools in your district, you want to distinguish the schools that are high level and high growth from the schools who may be high level but not making such great growth. Especially important in Minneapolis, we have schools that are not yet at the adequate yearly progress based on the MCAs, but they're making tremendous gains. They're schools that we call the beat the odds schools. And they need to be distinguished from the schools that are very low in performance on the standards and their growth is not there. So those schools are the intensive assistance schools in Minneapolis that are low on growth on our measures on the NWA and also low on standards from the MCA. So we think that you always have to have both. You have to have standards. You have to have growth. You need to be looking at those simultaneously. I'll come back to a few more comments about NWA at the end of this talk. I'm going to skip over some of the specifics of the growth model at the beginning, and really I'll come back to this, but I want to talk about more of the conceptual level first, because we had this discussion about growth and value added. Are they two completely separate things? And I'm of the belief that growth, as we've proposed it in the report card, is a subset of a larger family of value-added statistical models. There are about as many value-added models as there are statisticians out there, depending on what they want to include in terms of controlling for prior achievement, plus other demographics, and you can look at school configurations. You can add all sorts of things in, but the basic concept is, for value added, you're comparing individual student change, same student across years, to some kind of measure of typical progress. So no matter what the value added model is, it's making a comparison to typical progress. And the growth model that we're proposing for the state accountability system for the report card is one of those types of value added. Then I'd also like to comment on the value-added model that is permitted by the feds. I think the department The assistant commissioner has done an excellent job of getting input from the field, and we've chosen the best model that's probably most efficacious for us in Minnesota. One of our big problems is the very large number of high schools that are not meeting adequate yearly progress. Our standards are extremely high in high school, and you don't get much credit for growth currently because the standards are so high. You might make tremendous growth in the, you know, partially meets, but unless you cross that bar to meets the standards, you don't get full credit. This model that's been proposed by the assistant commissioner will give some extra benefit to high schools. It may get some of these high schools recognition for growth that they're making. But the feds won't allow us to do a true growth model in the sense of showing progress at every point along the distribution. As Christy mentioned, the students above the standard aren't considered at all. And then the students that are, you know, way below the standard might have to make, you know, tremendous progress to get credit to jump over the bar. So the model that's presented for AYP that's allowed by the feds is complementary. They don't contradict each other. These are two very complementary growth models. But the proposed model for the state accountability gives us a chance to be, different from the expectations that are imposed by No Child Left Behind. So to go back to the definitions, the growth model is really the change in this vertically linked scale score that the department put together last year, which can measure progress on our current MCAs. And we are proposing that the change from 2006 to 2007, these past 2 years, become kind of the norm, the regular expectation that we would compare all schools against. The simple calculation is you just subtract the scale score from 2006 from 2007, and the difference is the gain. The value added comes in, we take that gain and we go into a growth norm, similar to what Dr. Engemeyer mentioned for the height and weight charts at the doctor. We go in and see whether that gain is equal to or greater than the typical growth in Minnesota. And if so, we say the student has made at least the state norm growth. And if the student is below, we classify it as less than typical growth. In doing that, we can calculate for a school what percentage of the students in that school are making the typical state norm growth. And we can break it up by all of the No Child Left Behind subgroups. So here we can get at the issue of English language learners, of students in poverty, African American students who typically do not make great progress on our assessments. We will see what percentage of the students in Bloomington who are African American are making typical growth, what percentage in Minneapolis, what percentage for the district. And we'll be able to identify districts and schools that are beating the odds, that are making tremendous gains. We can even do it at the grade level teams and see, which grade level team in a school in Moundsview is making tremendous growth from 7th to 8th grade on the mathematics. So we can get down to the level of instruction by finding these teachers and these schools that are beating the odds. So that's the vision for it. We just tried to put together the simplest kind of a model possible that would be understandable by for parents and community members, for the media. We just basically said the state norm is the expectation. 50% of the students are going to be above, 50% below. So if your school has 60% of your students making state norm growth, you're adding value over and above typical. If you're at 40%, you have a ways to go. And then you can look at what percentage of the students by each of the subgroups. Now, we're given an opportunity to get the actual data from Minnesota for the last 2 years. And so we created the state norm for an example for grade 8 mathematics. How much gain took place from 7th to 8th grade mathematics? I ran all the data for Minneapolis, and my colleague Rick Spicuzza did the same thing in South Washington. What we found out was that only 43% of the students in Minneapolis were making state norm growth, whereas 59% of the students in South Washington were making state norm growth. So already I'm interested in finding out what's going on in South Washington. But then we drilled down, and here's a graph that shows you what you might be able to see is the state norm is 50%, Minneapolis was only 43%, South Washington 59%. But then what about the subgroups? And this is kind of a picture of what the report card might look like if it were on the website. You might be able to drill down to each of the subgroups that you have in your district and in particular schools. And I should have my pointer with me. But if I pointed at African-American or black non-Hispanic students, in Minnesota, only 43% of those students were making typical growth from 7th to 8th grade. So overall, we know 50% is the average, but only 43% of the African Americans. 61% of the Asian students were making typical growth. So there's a big gap there. Now, when I looked across at Minneapolis, I see 38% of the black non-Hispanic students in Minneapolis were making typical growth. So we've got a gap to the state, and we've got a gap to where Asian students and white American students, and you can see that's true for free and reduced lunch price students, for Hispanic students, American Indian students. There are very large gaps. And I think this is the best way to look at gaps because these are students that are continuously enrolled. They're in your building for at least a year, and it's how much progress they made from last year to this year, from 7th to 8th grade, compared to students who had the identical score as a pretest. So these students in the norms that we're comparing to have the exact same score as the student in Minneapolis. But the third column is a particular school that I found where they were making exceptional growth for students in mathematics in eighth grade. And here, 67% of the African-American students in that school were making typical growth, 67% of the Asian, 62% of the free and reduced price lunch. So you can see a school could get some diagnostic information on which areas they're making the greatest growth and which areas they're really not making progress. One interesting thing, and one of our colleagues on the committee said, well, why don't we have gender? You know, there's nothing in the federal rule that has you reporting out by gender. And, you know, I had never really thought of that in terms of the MCA results. We looked at gender, and from 7th to 8th grade, there's a huge gender gap. The boys are doing relatively less well than the girls. And we know that the girls were always higher in reading, but I think the myth was that the boys were always gaining more in math. Well, that's not true with our state test from 7th to 8th grade. So you can see only 45% of the boys in general in Minnesota made typical growth, 39%. And even the school A, as well as they're doing with African-American students and students in free and reduced lunch, they're not making very good growth with the boys either. So we may start looking for beat-the-odds schools that are showing great gains for boys as well as girls. So you get the picture of what this report card might look at. You don't eliminate the standards. The standards are still there. We still find out what percentage of the students are making the standards or on track for the standards. But then you have this additional dimension of growth where you can distinguish schools that are making great progress and follow up on those. So this slide summarizes what we just talked about. Now, in Minneapolis, we've done a number of these Beat the Odds studies, and they have been very helpful. They've been helpful to identify teachers in our district that are making tremendous progress in kindergarten and first grade reading. We're starting to do studies in mathematics now. Those teachers then can become part of your professional development, and they can become models. You can see what the effective strategies are by doing observations in the classrooms. And so the idea would be if the state would promote studies, follow-up studies on these schools and districts that beat the odds, we could all learn what are the effective strategies for Hispanic ELL students or for African-American students in the inner city, et cetera. This is a controversial proposal, but I bring it forth from my experience in Minneapolis working with the Sanders model. The Sanders model was designed to measure teacher effects, individual teacher effects. And my experience is that it's not a very effective policy tool or effective measurement process. When we get down to the individual teacher in the classroom, it's quite unreliable. The statistics are unreliable because of the few number of students that are continuously enrolled in some of these classrooms. So in the Sanders model, when we reported back to TAP schools, the Teacher Advancement Program, half the teachers didn't get any data because they didn't have enough students to even calculate it. Okay. And second, it took me a whole year to put the file together because I had to find out what percentage of the time each one of the four reading teachers for Sally were spending teaching reading. So it was, well, the mainstream classroom teacher had 70%, the ELL teacher had 20%, the special ed teacher had 10%, and then there was a Title I teacher. And they were all working with the same child. So it took tons of time on the part of the teachers to classify which kids were in their classroom. It would be a nightmare on the state level. And my third objection is that it rewards or punishes individual teachers, which might lead to competition among teachers within a grade level team. Instead of sharing the knowledge, they may compete. And I know this is controversial, but I thought I'd put it out there because our subcommittee really felt strongly that we should be rewarding, recognizing teams of teachers working together rather than distinguishing individual teachers. And even the TAP program that does reward individual teachers, it's only 10% of the reward or something like that is based on the individual. The second question was, what about NWA? We have 350 school districts in Minnesota using the MAP test or the CALT version from Bloomington, and some are even using paper and pencil still. Could we go to the NWA as the state test right away? And our team says not yet. We really don't have the technology in place in the state to be able to do it. We also would not receive permission from the federal government and the monitors. There's a technical team that meets to establish what you can and can't do with your state tests. We wouldn't, under the current law, the current federal law, this wouldn't be possible. Whether No Child Left Behind gets revised or dropped or whatever happens to that law, I think there may be a possibility for a more growth-oriented assessment at the state level. That's a possibility. But our opinion of the committee that had to put together these recommendations was no, not yet. And to be frank, we love our local assessments right now, and we don't want to lose the great thing that we have. So we want to proceed cautiously. There are advantages. The NWA assessments with their adaptive levels testing on the computer are much more sensitive to growth at the top and the bottom of the distribution. The MCAs, there are a lot of students that are getting 100% of the questions correct, and you can't measure growth very well for those students. We also have a lot of students at the guessing floor, and you don't measure growth very well. And what the NWA allows you to do is to go down in terms of difficulty of questions to find what students really can do and go way up above the standards as well. So there's good. This is the way of the future for assessment nationwide as adaptive testing. We think it probably has a place in our future. We just don't think that right now we need to push NWA. We can use the MCA 2 scale score. We're calling it the progress score. That will meet the needs of the state right now in the interim. And one can consider, you know, when the tests are up for a new RFP, whether the colleagues that are going to follow me next would be at the table to offer their services. So I hope I didn't run over too much.
Thank you. It's a wonderful segue. We do have one question, two. A question from Senator Saltzman, Representative Hosh. I know a few members need to leave, but we badly wanted to get your testimony in before a number of others. And then we will move into the final part, which is the NWA discussion. And obviously we're going to go a little bit over. It will be my commitment to you that we will not go beyond 3:15. So please hang in there. We had some people who traveled quite a distance to be with us from the NWA community. So two questions, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question, Dr. Heisted. When you talked about the Minnesota growth norms that were set in 2006-2007, how often do you anticipate resetting those? Because otherwise it would just seem to me that half of the schools are maybe always going to be under the 50% if you're constantly. So do you see revising those every few years? Or
excellent question. What our team proposed was that we would not reset the norms until the new tests and standards are developed. So when MCA3s or whatever the next version of the state test, one could renorm. But there is a real advantage to keeping the norms in place over a number of years. And NWA typically renorms every 3 to 5 years, I think. So we, and fortunately, they have their scale stays the same. If the scale stays the same, you may not even have to reestablish your growth norms. It's when the scale changes that you'd have to create new growth norms. So for the foreseeable future, the next couple of years, I think we'd use these 2006-2007 norms, and so that every school can show progress from that baseline.
Very good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And more of a comment or a request for us to not forget about, and we can discuss in a future meeting, but the growth models are extremely exciting, and I think it's the exact direction we need to go as a state. However, when I look at the working group and the testimony from Minneapolis School District, very little input from rural districts, and we need to make sure that we keep them in mind, because adequate yearly progress, that designation in a lot of ways significantly impacts rural districts that have smaller subsets within their groupings, and I hope we don't forget about them. We have some wonderful representatives and senators that represent the largest school district in the state, but I think we also need to remember that our smaller school districts are going to be impacted by this, and we need to hold their concerns in mind too. So,
Mr. Heisted, any quick words on
We need more representation from the rural communities, rural school districts. We have a Minnesota assessment group that meets monthly, and we do have folks coming from Mankato and Rochester and Duluth, but not as broader participation. I know on the list of NWA districts, there are rural schools there, but transportation is tough, I'm sure, to get there. I would actually like to meet with some of the outstate assessment and curriculum people to talk about this at some point. But I really recognize that need. And it is tough if you've got small cohorts. So what we're proposing is presenting the whole school on the report card, not the individual grade level to start with. You could drill down, but the first level would be the whole school, where you probably would have at least 20 students in some of the cells. It gets tricky when you get really small.
So in sum, there are valid distinctions that we need to pay attention to regarding geographic differences, particularly some of our smaller school settings.
And if I can comment, I think it's also a very good model for the charter schools. Charter schools, similar to many urban districts, have a lot of turnover, have a lot of challenges with diverse communities. But the way to measure their success is growth as well. It's just they have too much turnover to just look at last year's proficiency versus this year's. So when I've met with charter groups as well, I've recommended things like the NWA, because you can measure individual student progress and get a sense of whether you're producing achievement growth.
Thank you. And Assistant Commissioner, you don't need to answer, but you obviously heard Representative Hosh's concern. I take it that the department is also carefully making sure that there's that relationship and those perspectives at the table as you move forward. Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Heistad. As always, it's a pleasure, and I always learn. I can never write quick enough, so I just have to interact with you much more often. But thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your work at the working group. Our final testifiers are with the Northwest Evaluation Association. I believe we have Dr. Robert Baker and Mr. Charles Merritt. I hope I have that correct. And, sirs, I do apologize for moving the agenda around. You heard my promise to the committee members. We'll get us out of here at 3:15, so you have about 17 minutes. So thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the committee for the opportunity.
You might want to pull that up to your...
Okay.
We're having difficulty with the mics, apparently, so I think you have to be right on top of it. If you can identify yourself
for the
record.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And your name for the record, I'm sorry.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Dr. Bob Baker, and my role in NWA is Director of State Relations. My colleague is Charles Merritt. He is our Vice President of Government Relations. And we do appreciate the opportunity to provide information about how our Minnesota partners and districts use MAP as a K-12 growth assessment to improve student learning. NWA was founded 30 years ago by a small group of educators and psychometricians in the Northwest who are interested in developing an assessment that could accurately track growth on a vertical scale, which is equal interval, and that scale has remained constant and consistent for those 30 years. I would like to commend the Minnesota Department of Education for adding a vertical scale to their state assessment. That's something that is very rare to find with the state assessment. Our organization has grown to over 3,000 school districts and also serves many charter school organizations and entities such as Sylvan Learning and Teach for America. We also serve schools in over 30 countries around the world. We test nearly 4 million students each testing term, and as of 2 days ago, we delivered a total of 80 million test events. As pioneers in the adaptive testing arena, we've been able to collect literally millions of student growth data points that are stored in our growth research database, which is used by many researchers across the country. We're a not-for-profit organization and are true to our mission of partnering to help all kids learn. And I might add that one of our greatest advantages with MAP is the instant results that follow the administration of the assessment. We currently serve 363, to be precise, Minnesota partners, most of which are public school districts, but we also included charter schools and private schools in that number. Each test item in the NWA item banks, of which there are thousands, has been reviewed thoroughly for sensitivity and bias, beginning with the item writing phase to the field testing and calibration of each item to assure reliability and validity. From design to implementation and through application, our adaptive testing is focused on each individual student's growth and learning. We do provide grade level content mastery information through our norming study, in addition to defining the actual instructional level of each student, whether they be below, at, or above grade level. The indicative nature of our data helps instructional leaders and policymakers understand how students are growing academically to meet expectations. We track growth longitudinally from term to term and from year to year. Teachers use our data in association with a Minnesota version of a learning continuum that we call Descartes, which is aligned to the content of your state standards. This continuum provides learning statements associated with each student's instructional level for the purpose of informing child-centric instruction. Due to the many diverse levels of learning readiness in a typical classroom, We espouse the use of differentiating instruction to manage these many different levels and help teachers deliver instruction to the specific needs of each student. Teachers use many of our tools and resources to help them understand the data and help inform instruction. An example of one of these tools would be the individual student goal setting worksheet, which is automatically populated with the student's test scores, and it's used with parents and students to help them set learning goals and growth goals for the school year. We are a nationally normed assessment which provides typical growth targets for each student based on their grade level and individual performance as measured against students across the country. Our norm study is updated every 3 years, and our most recent study included 2.3 million test events, and our next study will be published this June. As I mentioned previously, our assessment can provide data about grade level content mastery as required by state standards and NCLB. We accomplish this by building a blended model test, as we did for the state of Idaho when we were their state assessment, which was approved by the U.S. Department of Education as an accepted measurement for meeting adequate yearly progress goals as established by each state. In our blended model, grade level questions are embedded in the test and tracked separately from the adaptive items. The blended model provides two scores, one to assess grade level performance and one that provides an adaptive score which determines their true instructional level. This differs from typical statewide assessments which focus mostly on state standards at individual grade levels. With our blended model, students below, at, and above grade level can demonstrate their true instructional level. Grade-centric data from a typical state assessment can't provide longitudinal growth of students, typically, from grade to grade because of a consistent vertical growth scale is not used, which would not be the case here in the state of Minnesota. There are two documents in your folders that give a more in-depth explanation of a blended model test and how it's built and our alignment process. A blended model assessment for Minnesota students could be developed in as little as 9 months. When looking at the extended use of our assessment here, the use of a blended model as a statewide assessment here in Minnesota would also provide a smooth transition from the years of longitudinal data they already own to the data being collected from the state. Mr. Chairman, thank you again for this opportunity, and my colleague, Mr. Merritt, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. We tried to keep it short.
Wonderful. Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there questions, observations? I know our working group struggled with some of these issues, and so I'm kind of looking over at our co-chairs here. Representative Breiner?
If there aren't any other questions, Mr. Chair, I would like to raise a general question. I've heard in several discussions about moving from NWEA as a local assessment to moving to a state assessment. Mm-hmm. One of the concerns I've heard expressed in a variety of manners is a loss of flexibility in the use of the NWEA for local needs. When it's given, how often students take it, what the timing is, what constraints we would come under in terms of it meeting the federal requirements might change how it's delivered and how the data is used.
Right.
Would you respond to that?
Certainly. In the blended model, there would not be the contention from the United States Department of Ed that we would not meet the specifications for being a statewide assessment. Can you repeat the first part of your question?
I'll try.
Okay. It was a long question.
Well, the question really is about moving from local applications to the state application and whether mm-hmm. local districts would lose their flexibility right. in its use within their own continuous improvement program, when it's delivered, you know, how it's delivered, and what constraints it would come under at the federal level.
If it were a state assessment, it would come under some restraints as far as defining test windows and things of that nature. The districts that do use NWA now, they have the freedom to test how often they want to test the students. I really don't know what else to add to that. Charles?
Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you might want to pull that real close.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. To address the question, we have heard many of the same concerns from the 363 partners that we have here in Minnesota, and certainly those would be critical issues for the legislature in particular to address. We would encourage the legislature in considering whether or not to allow the flexibility to move from a local to a state assessment to really be concentrating on making sure that there aren't any legislative barriers that would prevent the use either at the local level or at the state level in continuing to the way that our partners are using the assessments now. That would be our strongest encouragement, and it explains why when state-level RFPs come out, we don't always necessarily go for a state-level assessment.
And also, to answer another concern, districts would not be losing any of the longitudinal data that they have collected over years of using NWA. Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for presenting to us. I just had a curiosity, I guess. We had some discussion 3 or 4 years ago in our committee about this issue and testing trying to combine the virtues of the growth or value-added type of testing and its applicability to classroom usage, as well as the uh-huh. sort of norm-based testing that the No Child Left Behind and perhaps the state is interested in as well. But you mentioned that Idaho has a model that has been approved, and that's new to me. I know when we talked about this here before, we knew that there was some interest and that Idaho was trying to get this approved, but that hadn't been approved. So I guess, is that a recent occurrence, and are there other states that are using this model besides Idaho?
No, Idaho, we had their state contract for 4 years, and it was approved by the U.S. Department of Education. On their website for the AYP letters of approval, you'll find that our assessment was approved as for use for a statewide assessment. Unfortunately, when we did not get the renew on the Idaho contract, there were many rumors spread as to why we did not get that contract. And one of them being, we were never approved by the federal agency, and that is not true. The reason we lost the Idaho contract is that we, under our old leadership, decided not to respond to any financial penalties included in the RFP, thinking that since we had already been their assessment for 4 years that we could just negotiate that later. But when that proposal then went to the budget committee first, they saw that language and decided that it was a non-response. And so they took us out of the mix, and we never even got to the general committee to consider the RFP. So we learned a valuable lesson in that process.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we would be happy to provide for the committee a copy of the letter if you would like to see that. It was approved under then-Secretary Henry Johnson.
And, Mr. Chairman, just the other part of my question, are there other states besides Idaho that are doing this, or would we be the second if we adopted this?
No, there are no other states that were currently the statewide assessment. We normally, or we typically, If a state RFP comes out with a normative assessment component, That would be more of our strength than a summative type assessment, although we can do the summative type assessment with the blended model now.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think we have time for one more question from Senator Rubble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for coming. I understand you came all the way from Oregon.
Yes.
And I don't know how our weather compares to Oregon, but
a little colder.
We appreciate your coming. As you heard from the first witness, Superintendent Hooverman, one of his comments about, if he could change anything with what we're doing right now with statewide assessment, it would be to change how quickly the return on the information. Mm-hmm. So, in your blended model, can school districts get a return on the information as
yes.
quickly as they can on the regular model?
Yes, ma'am. Actually, the results are on the screen as soon as the student finishes the last item on the test. Then when that data is uploaded at night, they have their full set of reports the next day.
Thank you.
I just have one very quick final question. There are, technology issues. I imagine that those, prop up for you folks all over. How have you effectively done? I mean, that's not your issue. It's our issue
right.
in terms of properly resourcing, newer technology into our schools, and we're trying to do that. But how do you what have you seen in terms of, good practices with your other states and other districts or districts in general in terms of when you interface with folks who are struggling with technology issues and,
right.
and the use of your product?
We can certainly offer support to those districts as far as the type of technology that would be needed. In the meantime, we have a paper-pencil version of our test. And in the paper-pencil version, students take the test on different levels. And with each level, they get a score just as they get a score with a computer adaptive test. The only drawback to the paper pencil test is that there would be a 2-week return on results rather than immediate.
Still a pretty quick and decent return nonetheless.
Yes.
Members, I did promise we would adjourn at 3:15, and I intend to keep my promise. I do want to acknowledge Dr. Baker and Mr. Merritt's presence here. With us, the NWEA community and its tool is well used in this state,
yes.
and has clearly brought good benefit to our instruction as educators. So I want to acknowledge that, and also thank you for your traveling long distances to a cold place to share some thoughts with us, members. There are a number of other areas that we do want to get into by way of sort of orientation, if we will, on testing, on our broad testing questions. And so we're seriously considering a second meeting pretty soon. We're looking at February 6th, which is also the date in which our work group meets at 4 o'clock that day. So we're roughly looking at, say, at 1 o'clock on February 6th. Please, and obviously we're not in session, so we'll cover the per diem on it, but please watch your emails. We'll get a notice out to you real soon. I want to thank you all for your diligence. This is work that inquiry work that's very difficult. It's not the kind of stuff, if you will, that most of us spend a lot of time with. But I really appreciate the diligence that you all brought to today's conversation. So with that, I want to thank everyone in the audience and our presenters again, and we stand adjourned.